All right, I'm Tarek. I'm an addict.
Hey, Tarek.
And I've been tasked with talking to you about steps 8 and 9. I was walking outside and I overheard, I don't even know who said it, but something about getting an ODing on the big book. Perspective is a really important thing in any spiritual path that you walk. But we are a storytelling society. That's what we are. That's where the healing begins, is when we share our stories with one another. So this has not been a trip through the big book of us telling you the mechanics out of the steps today. We've been sharing our experience with the effects that are produced when you follow the instructions in this recipe book. Because this is what this is. This is a recipe book. It says do this, and do that, and you'll get this, this, and that. There are guarantees in it. You know, there are promises in it. From my own personal experience, they have come true. Does it mean they stay true? And I experience them every day? No. But they've given me glimpses into a potential and a possibility. And so it saddens me when I'm walking by and I hear a comment like that, because it tells me that something's being missed by the person who said that. That's not what's happening here. We're not trying to OD you guys on the big book. We're trying to hook you by sharing our experience with you. And my amends hooked me. One of my mentors, he says his first set of amends hooked him. Hook, line, and sinker. I've worked in this industry for the past 3 years, and that same individual used to make a comment that I would hear in passing, that the 9th step is the ultimate surrender. And now being in charge at a 12-step immersion program and watching how very few people make their amends, I can see now why that statement is true, that the 9th step amends is the ultimate surrender. But I don't even think the surrender happens in the 8th step. I think the ultimate surrender is actually in the 8th step, not the 9th step. Because if you don't experience a willingness to make your amends, you'll never make the 9th step happen, period. So it's really about the 8th step. That's where the freedom is, when you become willing. Most people don't access the freedom because they never become willing to make the amends. And so I want to go deeper in how important this 8th step is, because I'm a guy that believes none of us would be sitting here if it wasn't for the 8th step. When they first had 6 steps in the Oxford group, one of them was restitution to those harmed. And so I love AA history. Dr. Bob did not stay clean and sober when him and Bill met at the Cyberlink Gatehouse on Mother's Day 1935. All right. Now, what happened to him on that day, for the first time, he knew what he was suffering from. He knew the grave nature of alcoholism, and he was real fascinated that Bill Wilson was not there to talk to him about Bob's drinking. Bill was there to talk about Bill's drinking, and in the process of him sharing his story with Bob, a part of Bob healed to some degree. And then Bill moved in with Bob, and they started talking about the possibilities that they could do with this Oxford group and these 6 steps. But then there's this point where they're like, Bob turns to Bill and's like, you can't live with me for the rest of your life. So we got to find out if this thing really works. You know, I'm cool with all these 6 steps, you know, deflation of ego and intensive work with others and trust and dependence upon a higher power and all this stuff. But this thing about paying off, you know, restitution, I'm not down with that. You know, I've virtually lost my medical practice. I don't want to go around telling people even more things about me that could ruin my standing in the community, as if it wasn't already ruined, because everybody knew he was a drunk. And so he goes off to Atlantic City for a medical convention, and he's drunk on the train on the way to Atlantic City, doesn't remember anything about being in Atlantic City, and ends up at his office manager's house. And then they got to nurse him back to health. And remember, he was unwilling to make his amends. And so he's got a surgery coming up, and he wakes up the day of the surgery, and I think at this point him and Bill have been sleeping in the same bedroom, and there's 2 beds in the bedroom. And either when he wakes up that morning or when they drop him off at the hospital, he turns to Bill and says, Bill, I'm going through with it all. And Bill just assumed he was talking about the surgery. Well, they dropped him off in the morning, and Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob's wife, Ann, are sitting around waiting on him all day long, and there's no sign of Bob. Surgery was in the morning. So by 5, 6, 7 p.m. in the evening, they all think he's on a drunk. About 11 o'clock or midnight, Bob rolls in. They're like, "Bob, where have you been all day?" He said, "I've been going around Akron setting up all my men's." And so we all sit here on this Saturday afternoon, not because of the 12th step, because Dr. Bob became willing to make his amends. And I truly believe that the freedom is not in the actual making of the amends. It's when you become willing to make the amends. So, the process here that's outlined in the big book says that we got to start off with some willingness. Somewhere along the way, if you make decisions and take some actions, that willingness transforms into this degree of faith. And then you stay on the path and you make some more decisions and you take some more action. And somewhere in there, the faith transforms into trust. I believe that happens in the 9th step and the 8th step. The miracle of steps 6 and 7 that Lindsay and Jamie so eloquently described happens in the actions of steps 8 and 9. There is something that happens in the remission of character defects. I don't believe character defects get removed. I think they go into remission. Think about it. What is our greatest character defect addiction? Alcoholism. And it goes into remission. Can our addiction and our alcoholism come out of remission if we don't treat it? Absolutely. I think the same thing happens with the rest of these defects of character. And so, when I first started making amends, I got my ass handed to me quite a few times. I had a lot of people that said, "Hey, I'm glad you're doing well. I never want to talk to you again." I had a lot of people that said, "Hey, I can't believe you still think about that shit. Move on with your life." But as I reflect back on it, I mean, I stayed willing. You know, when I got clean and sober, my 8th step, my sponsor gave me a specific instructions. Dante said, "I want you to make a list of the people you're willing to make right now. I want you to make a list of the people you're going to be willing to make later. A list of people you might be willing. And then you get to make this list of people you're not willing to make amends to that you never have to make amends to." And that was a really important list for me early on because there were a bunch of people I was not willing to make amends with at the very beginning. And I set out and I started making as many amends as I could on the ones I was willing to do right now. And what happened is if you sit across the table and you look into someone's eyes and they describe to you what you have done to them as a result of your addiction, in a lot of cases, guys, I was making amends for stuff I did stone cold sober. In the 5th step, it says that selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. It doesn't say alcohol. So they have to. I think that is expanded into what we're making amends for. But I have seen a handful of times over the years where people get to this 9th step and they think all the amends they have to make have to do with the stuff they did while they were getting high or drinking. I don't believe that to be true. And I'm going to share. The best way for me to talk about amends is to share with you some amends. And I started to make a list, and I have been very blessed that I can probably sit up here for 5 hours and talk about nothing but 8 and 9. I can because I've been making amends for a very long time. It took me 8.5 years to approach every person or institution on my 8-step list, 230 ballpark. Why do I sit up here and do that and share that with you? Is there an aspect of it that's probably bragging? Yeah, probably. But there's a greater aspect of it because I want you to know it's possible. The big book says a long period of reconstruction. But what happens is people get to the 8th step and they think about those 5 amends that they don't want to make. And they become paralyzed and they don't make any amends. That's why the never list is so powerful. Now, I don't work with the 4 lists anymore. What I do is we work on a plus and minus system. So as you make your amends note cards, every person or institution gets a card. And then on the card, you write down, okay, this is how I contact them. I contact them by Facebook Messenger. I don't make an amends on Facebook Messenger. I send an approach letter, which looks like this. "Hey, I know we haven't talked in quite some time. I've been going back through my life trying to repair all the damage that I've caused. It's quite clear that I harmed you. Would you be willing to sit down so I can make things right with you? Here's how to contact me. Period. Those are approach letters, but I have seen, specifically now, because before I ran my own program, the only time I got to communicate with my sponsees was in this 2 hours that we shared during the week, and what I realized is whatever state of consciousness they have in those 2 hours, that's the filter for what I get. They can be completely delusional, and I have no course of action other than to wait until the shit hits the fan. Right, I have to take them at face value and assume they're being rigorously honest. But now that I run a program and I watch these guys, I see how they're paralyzed to even send the damn approach letter because they're not willing. And so it's becoming more and more real to me how very few people make their amends. And so why the instead of the never list, when you do plus and minus, you put in the top right-hand corner, plus, I'm willing, minus, I don't know how to find them. Plus, I'm willing, plus, I know how to find them. And then minus, I'm not willing, plus, I know how to find them. And then minus, minus, I'm not willing to make this, I have no idea how to find this person. And when I'm working with a guy and he's made his 8-step list, now I say to him, I want you to only work with the plus, plus. I don't care about these other note cards. Let's just attack the plus, plus. And then we see what happens. But I'm also seeing guys that just aren't willing to do that. So more and more it's being proven out of my experience and observation, which I'm not judging, but I'm observing that very few people have the willingness to make that amends. And think about it, guys. Whoever your sponsor is going to hold your hand the entire process. Even in the 8-step process, he's going to be there, she's going to be there to tell you exactly what they did. And then they're going to share that with you, and then they're going to suggest that you do the same thing that they did. But when it comes to making the amends, your sponsor is not going with you. It's only going to be you and your conception of God. That's it. So where do you think the trust is born? Trust is born in that. You take that leap of faith to go make the amends, and you see what happens. So I had a guy not too long ago, calls me up, shares with me his experience with the amends. And this has actually happened a handful of times over the last year. And the person he made the amends to really handed it to him. I'm talking, you know, explain to him how it hurt them, how they felt, how they thought he was a piece of shit in some cases. And he's explaining to me, and I said, well, did you ask all the questions? Did you ask if you left anything out? He's like, yeah. And they based on the 45-minute conversation, I know they discussed with you how it made them feel. Did you ask how you can make things right? He's like, yeah. I was like, brother, that sounds like an amazing amends. What's going on here? Well, I didn't feel good after the amends. And this is what I was talking about earlier, that this and Jamie and Lindsay talked about it. Several of your speakers have talked about this, that this the amends process is not going to feel good, period. But there's freedom. Freedom doesn't always feel good. The process of getting to the freedom doesn't feel good. Ask any people that have been involved in some type of revolution. Getting to the freedom did not feel good. It was full of pain and struggle. But these steps that we've talked to about up to this point are the launching pad into the world of the Spirit. They are the launching pad. And a lot of people don't get this far. A while back, I had a guy sitting in the office in my program, and his parents have been sending them to 12-step-based recovery centers, whatever the fuck that is. And they were convinced, they paid out all this money. My son has tried the 12 steps. They do not work. Okay. So I sit down and I start asking the son some questions. I said, let me ask you, when you went through the steps, you created this list of people, institutions you'd harmed. Did you go out and make every amends that you're consciously aware of? Well, I made my mom and I made my dad and I made my brother and I made my sister. And it stopped there. Okay, so how old are you? You know, at this point, I think he was 29. And how long did you use? Oh, since I was like 16 or 17. Okay. I'm willing to bet in 14 years of using, you harmed more than your mom, your dad, your brother, and your sister. All right, you could probably bank on every employer you ever worked for. All right? And so we started discovering that his amends were not made. Okay, cool. Let's talk about the 10th step. And when I'm dealing with a 10th step at that place, I'm like, did you build a network of guys around you that knew everything that was going on, that you were sharing your darkness with, that you were sharing your struggles with, that when you were doing things you didn't want to do, did people know about it? Well, no. Did you learn how to pray and meditate every day? And then this kid in this case said, I learned how to pray, but that wasn't happening at the end. And did you ever sacrifice your personal time? I'm talking about college football on Saturday and Sunday to go work with somebody, to show them how to work the steps. Well, no. Well, what do you think I had to do at that point? Well, I had to turn to his parents and say, you just threw away $25,000. Because that's what most of these programs do, isn't it? All the 12-step based means is they want you to get your own sponsor, go to meetings and work the steps, you fend for yourself, and do some bullshit on the side, right? No, like, nobody really talks about this part of the process, which is repairing the damage which will reconnect you to humans. What you're doing when you make amends is you are restoring. You're making whole. Not only you, but someone else. And no program's teaching this. Addiction, and if this, there are studies on this, that addiction is a disease of isolation. And so the opposite of isolation is connection. What more connecting part of this process is there than this right here? This is it. And I get accused of being militant. I get called some really nasty names. But I have been fascinated over my 3 years of how I've had to educate families on how their loved ones have not worked the 12 steps ever. But yet they've been going to all these 12-step based programs. Right? Here's the reality. You can't sell the amends process. You can't bill an insurance company for making your amends, can you? You can just bill for drug screens, right? The stuff that really matters, you can't bill for. Right? And I'm going to talk about this probably from now until whenever I can't talk anymore. Right? Because I think it's sad. It's very sad. I mean, let me get a show of hands in here. I do this from time to time. How many people in here have been to treatment more than one time? Let the record show almost 3/4 of the room. All right. In all those treatment centers you've ever been to, anybody ever worked there that said, that pulled you aside and look, based on your track record with alcohol or drugs, whenever you start, you can't stop and you cannot stay clean and sober to save your ass on your own. In my experience, when that happens, you gotta go through this process, and it involves going back into your past and repairing all the damage you've done to the best of your ability and paying back all the money. You're going to have to learn how to develop a network of people around you that you're going to be accountable to. You're going to have to learn how to pray and meditate, and then you're going to sacrifice your personal time to go help other people work the 12 steps. Who in here, in any of those treatment centers you went to, had someone tell you that? Three. That's the solution. In my experience, I've met very few people. For every 10 people I meet that struggled with drugs and alcohol in the past and now are clean and sober, that fit the description in this big book, most of them went through a treatment center, then got into a 12-step fellowship, and they stayed active in that fellowship. That's what happens to most people, be it NA, CA, AA, HA, CMA, whatever it is. That's where they ultimately end up. But why isn't there more focus on where everybody is ending up and achieving success on the front end? Why is it not talked about how important it is to make these amends? And so when I sponsor guys through this part of the process, I stress the line in the big book. I think it's on page 77. It says that our primary purpose right now is to be of maximum service to God and His fellows. How much greater can it be than restoring relationships? And then it says later on that the spiritual life is not a theory, it has to be lived. And to me, this is how you live the spiritual life. You restore. You make whole again. And so what I want to do at this point is I want to share some amends with you. Because I'm going to, with these 7 amends stories I'm about to share with you, I'm willing to bet it's going to trigger a memory of something you may have going on. And the reason I share this with you is because we are a storytelling society, and by me sharing this with you, you might approach me to ask a question, and if I have that experience, I get to help you through it. And if I don't, I know enough people where I can put you with somebody that has that experience. Because if you fit the description, this is the disclaimer for everything that I talk about. You have to fit the description of the alcoholic on page 44 or the addict on page 44. If when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely, or if when using and or drinking you have little control over the amount, you're probably an addict or alcoholic. And you might be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Well, part of the spiritual experience that the book prescribes is this amends process. And this process has changed me. Has literally changed me. And so the very first one was my dad. My dad was alcoholic. My dad was a drunk. My dad never remembered my birthday. My dad never came to my basketball games. My dad physically abused me, verbally abused me, emotionally abused me, verbally, physically, and emotionally abused my brother and my mother. I have memories of my dad with me sitting on the staircase and him stomping on me. So when I got sober, I just read you off my list of resentments towards my father. And I had 16 or 17 resentments towards my father. And after each resentment was read, the guy listening to my fist dev, Randy, he would ask me this question. So when I said hypocrisy earlier, this is really where it comes from. I so vividly remember this. He would say, "Hey, have you ever forgotten someone's birthday that you love?" "Yeah." "Did you ever not show up at a family function when you were supposed to be there?" I said, "Yeah." "Did you ever physically abuse somebody that you love?" I said, "Yeah." "Did you verbally, emotionally abuse those people?" I said, "Yeah." "Did you terrorize people in your life that you will sit here and if you tell me you love them, I'm going to be able to tell that you truly love these people. Did you terrorize them?" I said, "Yeah." And at some point when he was asking me those questions, my head dropped. And I knew what he was trying to show me, that I had become my father. And so Randy asked me, he goes, "All this stuff you've learned about addiction and alcoholism in this big book, it applies to you, right? Do you think it's true in your life?" And then he goes, "Well, if it's true for you, why can't it be true for your father?" And I realized that if all these things he's taught me out of this book and that my experience tells me is true, they can't just be true for me. And for the first time, like when I turned 18, like my brother and I both, we whooped my dad's ass when we were in high school when he was hitting my mom. He was abusing my mom. My brother and I both got no physical altercation. And so when I turned 18, there was no relationship with my father. I'm 31 when I got clean, okay? 31 years old, I get clean. And for the first time, I had a sliver of compassion for my father. And I went to make amends to my father. And I shared all of this with him. And I was making amends for being a shitty son. I forgot his birthday. I wouldn't show up if I knew my dad was there. I wouldn't give him the time of day. I never asked how he was doing. Set aside entirely what he had done, looking for my own mistakes where I'm at fault, I made this amends with my father. And from that point on, my father and I would go have lunch and a movie on most Sundays. And I grew closer to my father than anyone else in my family, to the point when last year when my dad got diagnosed, he got diagnosed with cancer in 2016. I was the one that spearheaded taking care of him in hospice. I'm the one that had to learn how to put my father in diapers. I'm the one that sat there and played music and meditated and prayed and read scriptures to him at the side of his bed. The man who beat me, the man who abused me, who abused members of my family. But what had happened is the time I spent with my father in part in making this amends and practicing these principles in all my affairs, it changed him to some degree. I learned a lot from him in those 10 years. That to me is one of the most amazing experiences I've had in my time sober, was being able to do that for my father. And you know, and part of it was for my mom to witness it because of the healing power and all of that, to the point to where my mom and my stepdad brought my dad into their guest house so we could do hospice for him in there. If I hadn't made this amends and restored that relationship with my dad, that wouldn't have been a possibility. My dad would have been in some home dying with probably only me there and some visitors from time to time. This way he had family 24/7 around him. This is what's afforded. I mean, this is what's available to you here. That type of life-changing experience. You know, I slept with my best friend's fiance They say you don't come back from something like that. I devastated a whole group of friends. I had to make amends for all that. When I went out with my buddy Chris, we went down to a restaurant. We made the amends. And it was probably, out of all the amends I've ever made, I've never had someone yell and cry that much like he did that day for what I had done. I was his boy. You know, we traveled all over this country going to panic shows. And we were thick as thieves. And I slept with his fiance. And we made that amends, and we started rebuilding our relationship. I made that amends in 2008. In 2010, there was a retreat out at the monastery. And the facilitator through the retreat asked us to bring an artifact that had a story or meant something to us. And so the first night when we all got to the retreat, we all had to get up front and tell the story associated with the artifact. That artifact I had was a rock, a pendant that had been wrapped by him and turned into like a necklace, and he'd given it to me as a gift because I think at that point our relationship had been restored. This is a man whose fiance I slept with, and I remember standing up front at the monastery, and like part of what I said to the group was, "This is the power of making amends." You do come back. Relationships can be, anything can be restored. Relationship. And I can't tell you the amount of guilt and shame that goes on for a man who sleeps with his best friend's fiance. I don't know if anybody in here has that, but you start to wonder what the fuck's wrong with you. You just do. And that was restored. Thank God he was willing to sit down with me. I tell that as a lead into this part. As a result of that, there were a bunch of people in our circle of friends that knew what was going on behind the scenes. And so a few of them approached me and his fiance and said, if you guys don't tell him, we are. Right? And so as a result, there were a bunch of people that took sides. And so I created a rift through an entire group of friends, and I had to make amends to them all. As I was going through all the people in that group of friends making amends, I got to this guy and his wife. And we used to use their apartment to meet up and have sex. She used to house sit for them and take care of their dogs. So they'd be out of town, and we would have sex in their apartment. And I made amends for that. I made amends for what I did to the circle of friends. And we were sitting at dinner. And when I told them about using their apartments, they both locked eyes with each other. And I knew something was going on. See, what had happened is one of the times me and that girl met in that apartment, we had left a used condom in their bedroom. And they found that used condom. They didn't know where that used condom was from. So, for years, they each thought the other one had cheated. They didn't know. They had lived in a marriage with that degree of uncertainty until I showed up that night to make the amends. And so we think we know why we were there to make amends, and we don't. And the other night, standing out at my home group, a guy I sponsor was telling a story about an amends. Don't you love it when someone's telling you a story and they remind you of something you haven't thought about in a really long time? So back in 2005, my roommate and one of my best friends fell four stories off a balcony, and he was in a coma. And at the time, he owed me money for like 300 rolls. And so this was after Widespread Panic was playing New Year's shows here, so that was all over and done. I bust up into the hospital. This is one of my best friends sitting in a coma that owes me money for 300 rolls. So I bust up in there, and it's my buddy and his wife. You know, I'm asking him a bunch of questions, but all I really care about is this motherfucker going to be able to give me my money for my rolls. And so Ross was telling me a story about his amends, and the guy he made amends to told him something he didn't remember. He had no idea about it. And I had not thought about that amends in a long time, but I went to that guy and his wife, and what I used to do, they used to buy OCs from me from time to time and other stuff, and I would rip them off. Or I would tell them, I would get a bunch of drugs, and I'd tell them, I'm going to set aside this much for you, but because I can't control the amount I do, I never have what I promised I was going to have for them. And I did this repeatedly, and they also had a five-year-old daughter I wasn't picking up my phone, so the wife came over all worried and brought her daughter, and I'd been up for days, and the daughter got scared as hell and really frightened her. And so I was going through all this. And when I went to make amends to the guy and his wife, you know what happened? I sit there and tell him all these things, and her husband turns to me and goes, "Dude, I don't give a shit about any of that. You busted up in the hospital and only worried about your money? You're one of my closest friends, and I wanted to fucking kill you." He goes, "That was one of the most painful things I've ever had to watch, was one of your boys laid up in the hospital, and all you cared about is he going to be able to pay you your money." And I hadn't thought about that in years till the other night when Ross was sharing the story. And the reason I'm sharing this with you is you think you know what you did. And just like Lindsay said, none of us know. We don't know. Those who say they know from the very beginning will come to know nothing at all. It's one of my favorite quotes. I show up there to make amends for one thing, and I find out it's something else. Right? I walked in on my girlfriend cheating on me. This was in 2000, and so I got clean and sober November 5th of 2007. And I bet, you know, you best believe that went on my never list. Right, I'm gonna go make amends to the guy that I busted my girlfriend with. And so in 2010, so I've been sober over 3 years at this point, maybe just around 3 years. This guy's on my amends list. I did a lot of screwed up shit to him after all that stuff went down. You know, I got violent when I walked up in his apartment, said a bunch of stuff, and I proceeded to assassinate his character, made friends turn their backs on him, all this stuff. I had to make amends for it, but I wasn't willing. So one day I'm driving down this road in Atlanta, and it's the middle of the day, and I'm driving towards the bar that he was a bartender at. She was a waitress, he was a bartender. And the idea comes, it's time to make an amends, and I was like, whoa, I don't know about all that. I remember being like, where'd that come from? And then the next thought was, okay, it's the middle of the day. He's the lead bartender. There's no way he's going to be there in the middle of the day. But you know what's going to be really cool is when I tell my sponsor I became willing and I went to the place and he wasn't there, right? No way he's going to be there in the middle of the day. So I pulled into this parking lot. I walked into the bar. It's a bar/restaurant. And he is the only one in the front of the house standing behind the bar. And so I walked up to him, and, you know, we'll call him Tony because his name is Tony. And I said, "Tony, can I get 5 minutes of your time?" Right? I do not suggest making amends like this, but this is the way this one worked out. There was no approach. I walked in, and we sat down at a bench. And you want to talk about that line in the big book that Bill and I read? To set aside entirely what you had done, to resolutely look for your own mistakes. And I told him how it was wrong of me to be violent that morning when I busted in on him, and the things I said, and that I tried to get his two best friends to turn their backs on him, and I got people that we used to sell him pot and not sell him pot. I mean, I went through my list. And he started crying. And it's one of those opportunities, it doesn't always happen, but he begged for my forgiveness. I made amends to him, and our relationship was restored. But this is not the most powerful part of this story. So my dad and I would always, you know, not always, quite frequently, that was one of the places we would go to eat before or after the movie. And Tony would stop what he was doing and come over and talk to me and my dad for like 3-4 minutes in a restaurant, sometimes in a busy shift, just to catch up, right? So over the course of time, we developed a pretty good relationship because I was in there a good bit. And so the amends was made in 2010. In 2016, this is 6 years later, I have one of my grand sponsees with me, and we're going to eat lunch at this restaurant. I walk into lunch. Restaurant's busy. Tony comes straight to us, takes us to our table. He talks to us. Man, we embrace like we're old friends. And he goes about his business. And then I told my grand sponsee the story, and he didn't believe me. He's like, "No way. You caught that guy fucking your girlfriend." I was like, "Yeah." "No, He just didn't believe that that was available to you to restore those kinds of relationships. And it happened. I had a friend of mine that I used to sell drugs to. And I knew he was really bad off on meth. I knew he was staying up days and being psychotic. But I had a bunch of drugs I had to get rid of, and I needed someone to buy them. I didn't care that I was probably contributing to this guy's mental breakdown. And so I would go and I would sell him the drugs. And it happened that in 2004, I got fired from a job, and he was buying a bunch of drugs with me. We were meeting at a bar, and we were sitting having a few drinks. And I said, I need a real job, is what I told him. I'm sick of working these non-real jobs. And he goes, well, my dad works for an insurance company, and you said you got insurance in your background. I bet you my dad will get you a job. So he puts me in touch with his dad and gets me an interview. Turns out his dad's the CEO of a company. His dad hires me as a benefit analyst. And I begin to work for his dad. Except at the time, I was smoking a shit ton of crack. And I did, for 2 years, keep this job. And I would stay up most nights, and I would go to work, being up all night. And I would do what I had to do. But eventually, I got fired for that. When I got clean and sober, he went on my amends list. So I went and made amends with him. But one of the things I was so fearful of sharing with him was that I sold his son drugs when his son was on his way to a mental breakdown. See, his son had a mental breakdown that he's never come back from. And this was a big man. Now, granted, he was a lot older than me, but he was a big man. And I could see the capacity to be rageful in him. But that's not what I experienced. I told him that I had sold his son drugs when I knew his son wasn't doing it, and that you got me this job and you had to fire me. And then he asked me what I did to be sober. And I explained to him the 12 steps. When I asked him what I could do to make it right, he said, "Will you please talk to my son?" And I got to make that amends, to make it right. I went and talked to Andy. But Andy was past, he ain't coming back from where he's gone. You know, he just ain't all there. But I did. You know, people are going to say, "I need you to, this is how you make it right. Talk to my son." Now, it took me 2 years to get in front of his son, because he would never return my phone calls, or when we would set some time up to meet, he would cancel on me. But finally, I got him. And we sat down, went out to lunch, and had a talk. Haven't heard from him since. But I finished that amends when I met with Andy, not when I walked away from his dad. So that's an important part. If you ask this question, what do I need to do to make things right? You may want to make a mental note, or at least write it down. Because in some cases, there are some specific things that you need to do. Now, if someone asks you for some... I wish I could remember. Somebody called me up and told me something that this person had asked them to do. And I was like, I don't know about that. You know, there are some things you need to consult your sponsor. Consult your sponsor. One more story. People are going to tell you not to make amends to your ex-girlfriends. Not true. Some of the most powerful amends I've had are with my ex-girlfriends. People are going to tell you not to make amends with drug dealers. Now, this is important, because I know this is going to be an issue with a lot of you. So, like, I used to go cop on North Avenue and Boulevard. The guys I did a grab and dash with, you know, I didn't go make amends to them. What I did was donate money to the Atlanta Union Mission, okay? But there were some friends that I used to get drugs, like big quantities of drugs on the front, right? And I ripped them off. These are people that I broke bread with, that I spent time with, that I traveled with. One of them was a buddy of mine, Jody. He had given me 1,000 hits of ecstasy, and I vanished. All right? Like a good crackhead, I was gone. And when I got sober, I had some friends that ran into him, and he said if he ever saw me, he was going to put me in the ground. So I made sure to steer clear of where I thought this guy could be. But then, and I got clean and sober November 5th, 2007. July of 2013, folks, I finally became willing. Now, I had a handful of other friends that I owed, like, you know, $500, $1,000, you know, stuff had gone sideways. I paid all them back. This guy, I had not been willing to make the amends. But I called him up, and I went to his house in Dunwoody, and I went into his office, and I was there was a little bit of fear in me, right? And we sat down, and you know, the one of the amazing things he said to me, he's like, if you had waited any longer, or if you'd come any earlier, I don't think you and I could have this conversation. So for whatever reason, why I waited over 4 years to make this amends, I don't know, but I came at the right time. And what, and the big book says we set up a payment plan. I set up a payment plan with this guy. Every couple of months, I take him $200 to $400. All right? And then, I mean, it took me a while. I just made my last payment November of last year. Okay, 4.5 years to make that amends. And during that 4.5 years, though, this is the part that, this is why I share the story. His son was in detox at, or his wife's brother was in detox at Peachford. He calls me up and says, hey, what's that stuff you do with the 12 steps? You know, Chris is over at Peachford. Will you go pick him up? So I got to go pick up his brother-in-law, take him out to dinner, and 12-stepped him. I shared my experience, and I described the 12 steps to him, and I asked him if it was something he wanted to do. I wish I could report to you that he'd stayed clean and sober. I get a call from him every now and then, but he didn't. But I did. I've held up my responsibility because I felt it wasn't a living amends, and I'm going to talk about living amends for a second, but in a second, I got to do everything the big book says to do. I 12-stepped him. I dropped him off with his brother-in-law and his sister. I went into the house, and I talked to them about the chapter to the wives and the family afterward. I told them, I said, look, if he gets into recovery, he may start neglecting his son. He may start to appear like he's neglecting the wife. But in those few months of healing, convalescence that the big book describes, it's really important to let them throw themselves into recovery. But I said in a few months, 3, 4, 5, 6 months, if he doesn't circle back and start to include his family in his recovery, then we know something's been missed. That's exactly what the book says. And I was able to live that part of the big book through that experience. But what, yeah, some sponsors in here tell you to chalk that up to the game. You don't have to pay them back. Bullshit. This guy was trying to help me, believe it or not, because he knew I was down on my luck and I owed a bunch of people money. He goes, look, go sell these pills, bring me the money, go pay the people you owe. That didn't happen. It was a great plan, but it didn't happen. So I'm trying to give you as many examples as possible when it comes to making these amends. But think about it. If you ever get active in sponsorship and someone relapses that you're sponsoring after at least a year sober, and they come back to you, the first question you have out of your mouth should be, hey, you had an 8-step list the first time you got clean and sober. Let's talk about it. How many of those did you make? How many were unfinished? You're always going to find unfinished amends. I have yet to see anyone that had finished all their amends. I did have one person, he almost got me, though. He had been sober for like 4 or 5 years. He relapsed, came back, told me he'd finished all his amends. Okay. And for some reason, I decided to ask him who was on that list, right? He only rattled off the family. Look, folks, if you have a mad dog war story, you harmed way more people than your family. But the family, and when I say easy amends, I don't mean like they're easy and there's no emotional pain. No, like my amends to my mom and dad, very emotional. But there was a part of me that knew, and this is holds true for most, not all, most of us, when we go make amends with family members, to some degree we know they're not going to spit in our face and they're not going to turn us on our fucking ass, kick us out the door and say never come back. The majority of the time. I've run into a handful of people that that's not the case. But for most people, that's going to happen. They're going to be open and receptive to listening. Right? You may not be able to make it right at that time, but they're open. But you know, when I had to go track down a guy from high school whose baseball cards I stole, didn't know, hadn't seen him in I don't know how long, have to go meet him at a Mexican restaurant, you think I was a little bit afraid when I pulled up in there? Yeah. This guy didn't know I'd stolen his baseball cards. He was not happy when he found out. Those are the amends where the trust happens, man. I was scared to make that amends. No, I wasn't scared to go make amends to my mom and dad. I was full of regret. I was full of pain. I was full of emotion, but I was not afraid. The fear getting overcome is what leads to trust in God. And that's why it's so important to make those amends that you're afraid to make. But nobody does that, because we play around in the rooms with this concept of living amends. Is that anywhere in the big book? I think living amends are some cute thing that someone came up with that didn't want to make their amends. And they pass it off. Because look, if you go to someone and you tell them how you were wrong, you tell them how you regret it, and you ask them what you can do to make it right, then that amends is done. It's about practicing principles in all our affairs after that. But people are calling it living amends, as if don't go back and make amends to all your ex-girlfriends. Just make sure you treat every girl from here on out good. I've heard that one, believe it or not. That's how you make amends to the women you hurt, that you treat every girl really good from here on out. Not realizing if you were to go back and talk to all those other girls and they look you in the eye and share things, that that's where the miracle is. That's where the connection is. That's where it becomes unacceptable to do that shit. You know, some of the stuff I did, you know, there are a lot of things that I used to do with women that I've never done since I got clean and sober because of those set of amends. Does that mean I don't struggle in the female department? No, I still struggle. You know, it's an area that I've struggled with the entire time I've been here. And I was married for almost 7 years, or with a woman and married with her for a long time. The cool thing is, because of this program, we separated and we didn't have to use lawyers. And we did it amicably and without hostility, and we are still friends to this day. Now, it's not like we hang out all the time, but she let me go and make amends to her, and I made my amends to her. You know, she has an extreme hatred for AA and CA, I'll tell you that. She's not in the program, so she felt like I was always not there. You know, as you go into the 10th step, could you imagine practicing a 10th step with all your amends finished versus practicing a 10th step with a bunch of unfinished amends? Because what do amends do when you start thinking about them? You can't take an inventory of yourself as you walk through the day if you're completely identified with all the people you fucked over all the time. Can you? I couldn't. Now, a lot of people think you got to make your amends very quickly. I do believe that, but you end up with, you know, as many as I had, I don't know how you get those done quickly. You know, I made probably 75 in my first year of making amends, then I stopped. And that's when I met this guy, Scott, and that's when I met Lindsay, and that's when I met Carl, and I started making my amends again, and everything went over to note cards. And I did it. I kept doing it, and I kept almost like every month. Now, with financial amends, I've been sober almost 11 years. So 11 times 12 is 132, I believe. Of those 100, and I'm still, like, I made a financial amends last month and the month before that, and I've got one this month. Of 132 months, I'm willing to bet about 100 of those I've sent a financial amends out into the universe. I've paid back now over $20,000, right? And the ones I'm paying on now are the ones where the people didn't want their money. A lot of my old employers that I stole from, they didn't know what to do with me when I went to make the amends. They said, we don't want the money. But I kept the note card, right? So now as part of my amends, and I'm going to share this with you. So all the guys that work with me at the launching pad, I've been buying them these books. It has their name on it with their sobriety date. I buy it as a way of making amends. You know, and this is going to be my thing. I've got a lot of money people didn't want. I'm putting it back out in the universe. I'm ordering these books. One a month, you know. It's $115 a month. Why? Because I've had more money than I need the entire time I've been clean and sober. Is there a connection with making your financial amends? Is there a connection with restoring relationships, what happens in your future relationships? It's, you know, I know a lot of you are in early recovery, and you're under the impression that this has a lot to do with shooting dope, smoking crack, smoking meth, and drinking alcohol, but it doesn't. It doesn't. It's about our selfishness and self-centeredness, and the best way to see that is we have to hold up a mirror. This is why accountability is so important. This is why the amends process is so important. Because when do you get to see a real clear depiction of that mirror? Because we, have you ever guys ever been in this thing where you've experienced yourself in a certain way and you remember certain things, and then you have a conversation with someone else and they experienced you in a totally different way and they remember a whole another set of things that happened? Well, if you make your amends, you're going to find that. You're going to learn things you're unaware of. And that's the way to find them out, is by sitting down with people and making these amends. There is a process and a system to this. You don't have the power to make amends until you've completed the first 8 steps. And that 8th step, guys, that's it. That is the linchpin to this whole thing. It's not the 9-step amends. It is your willingness to make them. There's a lot of freedom. And I had a guy come to me a couple weeks ago. I noticed a change in him just from him sending the damn approach. Just from sending the approach, there was an effect produced in this guy. Now he has to, now he's become willing to make the amends. Right, now it's up to God to bring the person into his life to make the amends. So I know I've been up here from my pulpit for like the past 35 minutes. Those are the major amends I like to share. I've got 10 minutes where it seems like whenever I do a workshop on the amends, that there are a lot of questions because people are probably terrified right now. All right. I think that's everything I have, because these first 9 steps, Lindsay said it really well, somebody else said it really well this weekend, a course of rigorous action. And for years I also thought it was about inventory, but it's not. It's about the whole kit and caboodle. Rigorous action all the way through. Right? And as my late grand sponsor used to say, how free do you want to be? That's what this process is about. If you want some relief, you can get it. I promise you. Make a couple amends, you'll be fine. You'll get some relief. But if this is freedom, if you want to be able to walk down any street on this planet and not have to worry about jumping across the street if someone's walking near you that you don't want to see, this is what it's about. I can tell you I can do that. There's not one person that's going to make me change my behavior that I run into out there based on what I did to them and I haven't made right. Not that I'm aware of. So, any questions on this? Yes?
How do you approach amends for people that have passed away?
I knew there was something I was going to get to. So, there are a bunch of people that had passed away, but also women on my inventory that I had no name for. There are women that I didn't have a last name for. And fortunately, the woman that I read all my letters to is sitting in this room. So I wrote a bunch of letters to these women as if I was making the amends and what I would do if God gave me the opportunity to make it. And I acknowledged to God that I was hoping one day I'd have a way to make it right. And I went to Lindsay and we sat in her apartment and I read all these letters to her. And some of those things are, when you sit across from a woman and you're a man and you read about the things you did to women, I wasn't practicing humility, but a part of me was humbled in that. And then my buddy Carl, I had a bunch of men that had passed away. And I can't remember if any of the women had passed away. But I did have some men in my life that had passed away that I owed amends to. And I wrote all the letters and I met with Carl and I read the letters. Now I've heard of people going to the gravesite. I've heard of going to a special spot. I've heard of surrogates. Like, you go find someone that reminds you of the person you owe the amends to and do it with them. But there is a way to make amends for people you cannot see. The big book says write a letter. Any other questions?
Can you clarify, Jared, on... Because I've heard a lot of people talk about you don't want to cause any more harm, right? And I don't necessarily know if that's like a cop-out about making a direct amends. Where do you really
find
online
stuff that you've done to it? Okay. So, I can't turn this recorder off, but the amends process requires discernment and it requires counsel when it's uncertain like that. All right, but I was on the phone with someone today or yesterday that was telling me some lady walked up to them at a meeting and told them that became willing to make direct amends except when to do so would injure them or others, and she was trying to convince him that she was an other, right? She didn't want to harm herself by making the amends. So you guys got to get this straight. You and I are not others. right? If the amends has the possibility of harming me, I have to take the bit in the teeth, so they say, right? But I'm going to give you an example. So, like, my mom, when I went to make amends to her, you think I, like, said, hey, Mom, you remember that time I called you a cunt and I grabbed that Dirt Devil vacuum cleaner and I hummed it at your head as hard as I could? That wasn't the way I made the amends. I said I disrespected you as a woman. I called you names no son should ever call his mother. And I did things to you that no son should ever do to his mother. And I regret it. So if I'd said the C word and just got really descriptive in that situation, it could have created more harm. Now, I went to some women from years and years ago that I owed amends to, that I had been unfaithful to. Do you think I told them I was unfaithful? They had no idea about it. I didn't bring that up in the amends either, because that would have just created more harm. But these are hard. I can't sit up here and give you a hard rule to follow. You literally have to call your sponsor, tell him what the situation is, and if you have a competent sponsor, if they don't have the experience, they say, hold on, I got to find you someone that has this experience so you can talk to them. Okay? That's not what you do. You don't want a sponsor that doesn't have the experience, that's going to give you his opinion on it, and you're like a blind man shooting in the dark. That's not what we do here. You find someone that has the experience, and then you see what happened. But yeah, there are situations where it's real great. That's why you got to talk to people. So I can't. There's no rule to follow in that regard, other than you don't want to create more harm. Now, any other questions? All right, that's all I got.